So welcome to week 4. Week 4, working through the concept of resilience, bouncing back from any challenge, no matter how big or small, as we've talked about the last few weeks. So what I want to do, just to recap so far where we're up to and then set the stage for today. So far we've talked about first step of resilience being discovering the spark. We all have within us that spark of resilience, that little spark at the depth of our soul, which is pure and transcends all challenge and is the catalyst to be able to bounce back and to rebuild, so to speak. Without, of course, minimizing, as we said many times last week, without minimizing the challenge or minimizing the pain, but acknowledging it and working through it. We've talked about the importance of the mind. The mind rules the heart. The mind is that vehicle, that opening the door that lets in messages that will allow us to connect with that spark of resilience, building a mindset of positive messages and so on. In last week, we talked a lot about persistence. In Hebrew, we called it netzach, the part of our makeup which is built to win, to overcome, never to give up, even though there might be setbacks or failures or things that stand in the way. But it's that sort of drive that we have deep within us not to give up and not to become a victim and not to give into victimhood, so to speak. But on the contrary, to learn how to turn failures into things which are catalysts for actually greater growth and greater strength and to become stronger from each setback rather than giving up. And just if I can just sort of summarize quickly what we talked about last week in terms of the strategies that we use for persistence. And we talked about, first of all, the number one step probably is the concept of believing in ourselves, believing that we have that spark, having the conviction that it is in fact possible, that resilience is always possible, not easy, but possible. That is sort of a critical stage, a critical foundation to the concept of resilience. We talked about visualization, which is the idea that when we suffering setbacks and things aren't going as smooth, even in the resilience journey as we want it to go, we visualize the positive outcome, how it would be when it needs to be the way it should be. We talked a lot about last week about reframing, about not changing the facts, but reinterpreting the facts, and reinterpreting in the way where we're not prepared to leave it identifying us as something negative, like in the case of Joseph, even though the facts were very harsh. He wasn't prepared to be defined as the brother that got as the son that got sold by his brothers. But on the contrary, he saw himself as having a mission, as having a purpose. So he reframed the whole story and was able to get rid of the resentment, able to bounce back, and able to be at peace with his brothers through that. And then lastly, we spoke last week about the importance of helping each other and believing in each other, and sometimes helping someone else just discover that spark. And a small gesture can sometimes, that story, the birthday card that I told you, sometimes that small spark, that small gesture can just help someone believe in themselves and believe that they're important and believe that they're needed and they have meaning. Okay. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, where we're up to. What I want to do today is explore a general strategy that is very, very important for developing resilience, but with an important introduction so you understand where I'm going with this. We know that in physical well-being, if someone is, God forbid, unwell or needs to go for any particular intervention or whatever the case is, we know that there's a sort of a very rational, logical principle which we all understand. We don't always do it properly, but we understand this concept. And one is that in medical healing or in the journey towards better health and so on and so forth, there's always two stages, there's always two components, right? One is where we provide intervention or treatment for a specific problem. So a person has a specific problem, an ailment, a disease, an issue, and takes medicine or has an operation or does treatment for a specific part of the body, for a specific issue, for a specific problem. And then we're always told that at the same time, it's important, both as prevention but even as part of the healing process, to have a look at and explore our general health, right? General good health, because we know that the two things are very, very linked. So the better someone's general health is, and this could be both physical and emotional and psychological and whatever, But the stronger a person is, generally speaking, it's not always that way, but the stronger a person is, the more well a person is, the better the effectiveness of the specific intervention will be. Okay? It'll last longer, it'll be better, it'll have more of an effect, it'll be better quality, whatever the case is. So although we might be dealing with a specific issue, but there's this value and this importance of having a look at general health. So if a person is generally healthy, eating properly or exercising or doing other things which are just good for their general health, it strengthens and supports the specific intervention. So why am I saying that? Because the same thing is true with resilience. When we talk about resilience, we're talking about bouncing back from a specific experience. It might be a specific challenge, a specific person was very hurt by someone else, a person suffered a tragedy, a person is going through an inner struggle. Whatever the particular negative experience is, resilience is the process with dealing with that experience and trying to bounce back. So in a way, resilience is a very specific thing. In other words, it has specific strategies, specific treatment, things that we've already spoken about, things that we will still speak about, but things like acknowledging the pain that we've talked about, things reframing, things working through the issues, trying to finding that spark, having the conviction that it's possible, making sure that we don't fall into a negative cave, but rather we emerge with something more meaningful and something positive, learning to deal with the setbacks, the failures that are part of the process of the resilience. So we're dealing in a resilience journey with a very specific, perhaps a specific experience. However, that specific journey of resilience in whatever experience a person is experiencing, whether it's a specific particularly bad day or it's a specific negative experience or challenge that they're experiencing at any time of their life, the journey to resilience is supported by general good mental and physical health. In other words, if we have a general positive mindset, if we've trained ourselves to generally be upbeat, generally be positive, generally have a more positive outlook on the things that happen in the regular, ongoing, routine life that we experience every single day, which are not that consequential or not that devastating or don't put us off, but just the general things that we experience every single day, the getting up in the morning, the workplace conditions, the person that cuts us off in the traffic jam, whatever the case is. If we are healthier there, if we are healthier in a general routine lifestyle, then when we suffer something much more negative, the resilience journey becomes that much more effective. Does that make sense? Okay. So in that context, what I want to explore today is developing this concept of a general strategy, which is, I want to look at today the general idea of having a positive mindset, the general concept of positivity. Also using the principle that we've talked about, which is Moach Shalit Al Halev, that the brain rules the heart. Also, we're going to use the mind and look at the messages we play in our brain all the time in every experience that we experience every day. But again, just clarifying, I'm not specifically focusing on a resilience journey when we've experienced something very negative. It's more about building a general attitude that is a support for resilience. Because this might not be an experience where we experience extreme pain that we have to acknowledge and give ourselves time to work through there. It's just a general concept of the things that happen to us every single day. But if we can build that mindset, then when we need resilience in a real way, it'll become much more easier and much more effective. So we're going to do this by exploring or revisiting things like optimism, just general positivity, and also bring in, and I know I'm doing a course currently at nighttime on this, but I'm going to bring in also the whole idea of gratitude, because it's very, very linked to this whole process. Now, we, I think, spoke about this last week or 2 weeks ago, that one of the great modern-day psychologists is Martin Seligman, and considered probably today the father of positive psychology, one of the fathers at least. One of the things I'm going to do today is draw something from one of his books called Learned Optimism. Very, very interesting book. Positive psychology is the psychology of, it moves, I mean, it's interesting, the whole science of formal psychology is relatively young, I think. It's about 100 years old, right? That's not, I mean, people have been dealing with the way the mind thinks. I would say Jewish thought has been dealing with psychology for thousands of years. But in a modern day sense, in a scientific sense, psychology as we know it today, as a science, as a treatment, as a strategy, is actually relatively young. But positive psychology is even a further younger development within the whole psychology process. And essentially, to put it very simply, it's instead of treating or looking at what's wrong, it's actually trying to focus and looking at what's right and strengthening that which is right. It's probably an oversimplification, but that's sort of what it is, right? Now, it's often used as a means to achieving things like happiness, and let happiness sort of flourish through what he calls acquired optimism. Okay. And as he explains, and I've said this a number of times already, that the good news and the bad news is as follows, but it's really good news, that these mindsets that people have, the attitudes that people have, can be learned and unlearned. He has a whole section where he talked about kids, where kids often get into a mode, and I've experienced this very, very much as a teacher, when I taught younger children, where sometimes children are unable to do things, and they really are unable to do things, but they're not really unable to do things. What I mean is, they're unable to do it in their current reality because they have what's called learned helplessness. They've actually learned to be helpless. Now, when someone has learned helplessness, it's not good just saying, well, you could do this. You know, you can do it, try harder. Because in their reality, they really can't. You actually have to teach him or her to unlearn the helplessness or to learn a much more positive attitude, right? So things like helplessness can be learned. And things like optimism and pessimism are also learned and unlearned behaviors. Often people are born with a certain disposition to one or the other. So we have people who are naturally more optimistic and people who are naturally more pessimistic. But even people who are pessimistic, his theory is that you can learn optimism. Now, I emphasize this a lot because it's completely in sync with Jewish thought, as you heard me say many, many times. But fundamental to Jewish thought is that we have bechira, we choose. Choose means we don't only choose our actions, we even choose our attitudes. We choose our responses. We don't choose what happens to us at all. Fundamental to Jewish thought is that everything's bashkacha pratit, everything's by divine providence, and that's ultimately what happens. I might plan the day, but ultimately the way the day turns out, or how the weather is, or even what people say to me or do to me, is completely out of my control. So I have no control over what happens outside of me, but I have all the control of how I respond to it. Because you've heard me say many times that the Talmud says everything is in the hands of heaven except for fear of heaven, which means that everything is in the hands of heaven in terms of what happens to me, but my moral choices God left in my control by design. He wanted us to make the choice between right and wrong, which means part of the moral choices is how I respond to a situation, what I do about the situation. If anything is remotely connected to a moral choice, including decisions of responsibility and how I plan my day and what doctors I go to and so on and so forth, that's all in my choice because that's necessary. What happens beyond that, what happens outside of me is not in my control. But I do have control of how I respond to a situation. Because responding positively to a situation is a positive thing, it's a moral thing to do. Responding negatively is destructive of my personality and sometimes can be a wrong thing to do. So therefore, that's my choice, right? Optimism is morally good. It's a morally correct thing. Why do I say that? Because it's linked intrinsically to the growth of the human being. We can only really grow if we become untrapped. You've heard me say this term very often. Right? If we remain trapped and we blame everything else outside of us and we give up, we can't grow. Central to the human condition is that we need to keep growing in a positive way. Growth is only possible when we see the opportunity. Growth is only possible if we see the possibility and the positive side to many, many experiences, which gives us the ability to take the next step and to become a better human being. So mindsets and optimistic or positive mindsets are learned. They can be learned things. Now, when I say they're learned, I need to clarify two things. It's always easy to talk about these things, right? But that's why we start that way, because you've got to start where it's easy, right? And that's why we need to keep talking about it, and talking about it again and again, and revisiting these concepts, because it's much easier to talk about than to do. When we say that optimism is a learned behavior or learned attitude, it doesn't happen as easy as it is to say it. Makes a fascinating discussion, and it's a very interesting one. But it's very, very hard. That's true. We need to acknowledge that. And optimism, as we'll soon see, also doesn't mean just like resilience doesn't mean going into denial. Optimism does not mean that we only see the whole world through rose-colored glasses and everything is wonderful and good, because everything is often not wonderful and good. That's not what optimism is. It's about how we interpret what is going on around us. So we shouldn't think that optimism means I'm going to have to go into some sort of fairyland existence. It's not. Optimism is about being, in fact, some people say, you know, optimist, the pessimist, and I'm the realist. That's another way of saying I'm a pessimist. right? Just a nice way of saying it. Because it's a misunderstanding of the word optimism. Optimism doesn't mean that I'm not real. Optimism doesn't mean I don't acknowledge the problem, I don't see the problem, or there isn't a challenge, or there isn't a little challenge or a big challenge, whatever. Optimism means that I choose to respond in a more positive way. That's all it means, right? So therefore, optimism is linked to developing a mindset which is all about developing something that's like having a bit of a more thankful type of personality. It will be linked to things like, just give you a bit of a preview, to sometimes it also means lowering our expectations and not having such a sense of entitlement, which sense of entitlement often brings to negativity and to pessimism, because everything is wrong because I always needed more. I just saw a little story the other day about a grandmother that was taking a little grandson to a beach, and suddenly a big, big wave comes and sweeps away the little kid, and she goes into a frenzy and she starts to cry out to God and she says, "Please God, it's my grandson." And suddenly there's this miraculous wave that brings the child back, and she turns to God and said, "God, he had a hat on him." Yeah. So a positive... It's an extreme joke. You know, things always sound funny and extreme. The problem is we all do this a little bit, because especially today, I think we live in a world that has a very strong sense of entitlement, and we have to sort of deal with that, especially with children. But that's contrasted with a negative mindset. Negative mindset is we have pessimism, cynicism, negativity, and all this kind of stuff. So what I want to do is have a look at a few ideas that address. And the first, I'm going to actually draw on two bodies of literature. The one is Learned Optimism from Seligman. The other one is Life in Balance by Dr. David Pelkowitz, who you've heard me quote a number of times. So he starts off a particular chapter in this book. He starts off by saying, and I want to share with you a very, very good strategy. He starts off by explaining that life inflicts to everyone. Life always inflicts setbacks, and it's full of challenges. I don't think we can avoid that. We can hope to avoid big ones, but we're always going to have little ones, right? And the difference between the optimist and the pessimist is how we weather these setbacks, how we experience them, and how we respond to them. So he develops a concept, a formula, and I think it's just a great way to remember it, a formula which is the ABCDE formula. But let's talk about the ABC first. It's in two parts. ABC is like this. A stands for adversity. The second is beliefs, and the third one is consequences. In other words, like this. Everything that happens in life to us, anything that's challenging, can be something small. There's the adversity, in other words, the challenge, this thing that got in my way. Okay? He gives an example of a woman who's on a very, very healthy eating plan and then goes on doing very successfully, doing great for 3-4 weeks. And then goes out to a restaurant. This happens to everyone. Goes through it, right? I mean, some people. And then goes out with some friends to a restaurant. And, you know, there was something there. And then just, she blows it that night. She eats, I don't know, chocolates or nachos or whatever the case is, right? So that's the challenge. That's the adversity. The second thing that comes in. Now, what happens often with such a person, let's just talk about the negative response. Because negative response, by the way, is not only negative about other people. It's often very, pessimism is often very much about negativity about ourselves. Okay, so then they will that person will then just decide, oh, you know what, this is crazy. I'm not able to do this. I knew I wasn't disciplined. I knew that it's, I shouldn't even try. I've blown it. Forget it. She goes home, opens up the freezer, and just goes for it. Right? Now, what's actually happened there is not two things. What's actually happened there is was that the wrong example? It's his example, not mine. Okay. What happens there is actually three things. What's happened? There's the adversity. In other words, she blew it. There's then the belief system. That's the belief. That's the message she has in her brain. And then there's the consequence of going home and totally blowing it. The belief is the negative view of ourself. The belief is, I blew it, I'm no good, I'm not a successful person, I thought I was committed, I'm not committed, I thought I'm disciplined, I'm not that disciplined, I'm hopeless. That's the belief. Then she goes home and totally indulges. That's the consequence. Okay. And everything that happens, happens A, B, and C. Adversity, belief, and then the consequence. The belief, this is the power of the mind. The belief is in our mind. Now the problem is this happens very quickly. And often happens very, very instantaneously, and it happens by habit, right? But it's important to dissect and to break those three things down, because what's actually happening is the circumstance, whether it was out of my control or by my control, the choice, whatever it is, it's the adversity. And then the response, but the response is fueled by a belief system, which is in my mind. And at the end of the day, the mind drives what we do. And that's what we have to look at. We have to look at that middle. We have to look at that belief that's coming in the middle. Okay. So just to give you an example, he gives a couple of examples where he breaks it down. So for example, someone, and I'm always accused of giving examples from driving, but it's him this time, not me, okay? Someone zips into the parking space you had your eye on. Hope it didn't happen today, but okay. So you're driving and you're about to take a parking space and someone cuts you off and takes the parking space. Okay. That's the A, that's the adversity. Then he jumps to the C and he says the C is you get angry, you roll down your window, you shout, you swear, you blame, you do everything, right? That's the consequence. What's the belief in the middle? He saw me, he knew I was about to take the thing, he's a hopeless, he's a rude person, he's a terrible person, how dare he do that? And then I respond. Okay, that's the belief. Okay. Your best friend hasn't returned your phone calls. So there's a belief and a consequence. You might be depressed all day because you have these, if you're a pessimistic person or leaning towards pessimism. How could it be? It's the best friend. I've called them. They haven't returned my call. Right? And then there's the consequence. The consequence is, obviously, she's not my best friend. Or, I thought she was that friendly, but no, I thought she, all this kind of stuff, right? Or you yell at your children for not doing their homework. And then you think, that was kind of wrong. So you think, I'm a lousy mother. And then you feel low, right? So there's everything happens. There's an adversity, there's a belief, and there's a consequence. So when you scream at the driver for cutting you off and you tell him it's a really rude and selfish thing, that's fueled by a particular belief. Okay. Now, when we talk about adversity, again, to make it clear, this is daily routine stuff. This can be anything, right? It can be a leaky faucet, a leaky tap, right? It can be just someone looks at you the wrong way, you know? And we often jump to conclusions, and the conclusions actually have a real negative effect on how we respond, can have effect on our whole mood of the rest of the day. You know, something goes wrong in your building, the builders that built this building are just like hopeless, you know, they just didn't know what they were doing, whatever the case is. All this kind of stuff, right? There's so much of this that happens every single day. That's what I'm trying to emphasize, is because it's about really having a look at our general mindset of every single day. How positive we are, how negative we are. Not because that's the same strategy that works in real resilience journeys. But if we want to engage in real resilience, we have to strengthen our general mindset. That's what I'm trying to bring out. Because then it'll be much, much easier to then, when we have real challenge and real setbacks, to be able to reframe and to reinterpret and to bounce back, because we've already trained our minds to do that, right? So therefore, what he says is the following. When we have this ABC formula, and if it's not working, in other words, if our beliefs are automatically, instinctively negative, which then lead into a negative consequence, what we have to do is we have to go to the D and the E. Very, very great formula. And the D is disputation or distraction. He advocates for disputation, which means you could distract yourself in a negative thought, but that's not as effective. But the most effective thing is to dispute. To learn to argue with yourself. In other words, to learn to understand and recognize what your belief is, and then to challenge it. And to challenge it well. And we'll see how you challenge it in a second. When a person can learn to dispute, to challenge, to argue with their own belief system, then he will or she will land up with the E, which is energization, he calls, which you re-energize, you become positive, and you bounce back and you're ready to go on. Okay? So for example, let's go back to our example, and he gives a few other examples. Someone cuts you off and they take your car. There's a belief he or she is a rude person, they knew I was there, you get all angry, right? So they're getting angry, and we don't feel good after we get angry. Normally, generally speaking, most people, when they rant and rave and they lose their cool and they swear at the driver, whatever the case is, they don't feel good for the next couple of hours, right? So the idea is it happened. The idea is then to challenge. Why? What did I do? What actually happened? It was based on a belief. Let me challenge the belief, right? Now, challenge the belief is we can do it many, many ways. But if we challenge the belief, maybe he didn't see me. Maybe actually it wasn't his fault. Maybe actually whatever. Maybe he's got an emergency. Judging people favorably. Whatever the case is, if I can challenge the belief, I can change the consequence. All right? Clear? Now, how do we do that? How do we challenge our belief? He says, first of all, we have to start. He gives three things. He talks about evidence, alternatives, implications, and usefulness. I think I put them on the. Did I put on? Yeah. The evidence is we first need to make sure we've got the facts right. Right? Very, very often, we jump to conclusions and we develop a belief in our mind that is based on untrue facts. Now, from a Jewish point of view, this is so important because so. One of the fundamental concepts we find in Bekei Avot, again, one of the most difficult things to do, is not to be judgmental. We judge other people, we jump to conclusions, and often when we jump to conclusions, we create in our own mind facts, statistics, belief systems that are simply not accurate. He didn't see me. Maybe he saw me and took the progress. Maybe he didn't see you. How do we know? My friend didn't call me because they're angry with me. Maybe they just have an emergency or they're really, really, really busy. Right? So it's about challenging the belief system on the basis of evidence. What is the evidence? So we need to challenge ourselves by actually checking out the evidence. Maybe the evidence is simply not what we thought it was. Okay. Then there's, the evidence also is about the evidence on ourselves. So like, That story of the person that blew the eating plan. So I'm hopeless. I'm undisciplined. I'm right. That evidence also needs to be challenged. Who says you're undisciplined? You know, one of the concepts we found. I'm sure I've mentioned this before. You know, one of the prohibitions in the Torah is speaking lashon hara. You're not supposed to gossip and talk badly about other people. So we know that the Chafetz Chaim, the great Chafetz Chaim, who was one of the great thinkers and writers about this topic. Which is why he was called the Chafetz Chaim. His name was actually Yisrael Meir HaKohen Kogan, but he was called the Chafetz Chaim based on a verse that in Psalms that says, who desires life? He who protects his own tongue from speaking evil. Right? So the Chafetz Chaim says that he learned from his own personal story that you're not allowed to talk Lashon Hara on yourself. It's a prohibition. The prohibition of Lashon Hara, of gossip, is about yourself as well. He said, how did he learn it? He was once on a train, and he was traveling home from somewhere. He lived in a city called Radin. And he was sitting next to a person and he got to know a person sitting in the same train cabin. They didn't know each other. There was no photos in those days. So he says to the guy, where are you traveling? He says, I'm to Radin. The Chafetz Chaim says, I'm also traveling to Radin. So the Chafetz Chaim is making conversation, being nice, being pleasant with the person. He says, and tell me, why are you going to Radin? So he says, I'm going to see the Chafetz Chaim. He says, why are you going to see the Chafetz Chaim? So the guy looks at him like he's mad. What do you mean, why God? You don't know the Chafetz Chaim? Chafetz Chaim, one of the greatest tzaddikim, greatest righteous people in our generation. He's a Torah scholar. He's a publisher of the Code of Jewish Law, the Mishnah Berurah. He's an amazing, amazing person. So the Chafetz Chaim says, you're mistaken. He's actually not such an amazing person. So the guy gave him a slap. He got so upset that he slapped him. Said the Chafetz Chaim, he learned from that story that it was wrong what he did. He learned from that story that you're not allowed to talk Lashon Hara on yourself. You have to be humble. You know, maybe you didn't have to say, yes, you're absolutely right. The Chafetz Chaim is the greatest person that ever lived. But he could have just acknowledged and said, okay, that's a great idea. I'm happy you're going. And then let the surprise come out later when he comes in the room and he sees who it is, right? But it's a very, very important thing, purely on an ethical thing. It's unethical to put yourself down. Now, a person has to be honest with themselves. Honesty is totally different. Honesty is about factual. Honesty means I made a mistake, right? Lashon hara means I am judging the mistake. It's very, very different. If I've done something wrong, if I've been unethical, if I stole from someone, if I cheated, if I did something wrong, if I screamed at someone, if I got angry, that's a fact. A person has to be able to evaluate and assess their own weaknesses. And if I'm someone that gets angry quickly, I have to be able to be honest with myself. But when I judge that mistake and I say, you know, not only I got angry with myself because I'm a bad person, I'm a hopeless, and I'm not able to do it, and I'm out of control, and I'm undisciplined, that's Lashon Hara, right? And that's evidence that's not necessarily true. I mean, some negative evidence is true. If I made a mistake, I made a mistake. But if I'm putting myself down, if I say, well, you know, I'm not able to keep this, and I'm, who said that's true? Maybe, you know, it wasn't such a bad day. You didn't have such a good dinner, so a little bit of extra you had at the restaurant wasn't terrible. You did it for 2 weeks, which is actually a good thing, and you can do it for another 2 weeks, and one night's not going to make a difference, so you bounce back the next morning and you start again. But it's all based on the belief, and the belief is the evidence. You put yourself down, and we often do that. We often get upset with ourselves, because not for what we've done, but we give reasons for what we've done. We assess our character, and that's based on evidence, which is sometimes completely untrue. Then there's alternatives. Right. Sometimes we get into a very, very pessimistic frame of mind because we just can't see any alternative. Like, I know this is not going to work. If there's a 1% chance that this is dangerous, that's not going to work. It's definitely going to turn out a disaster. Right? Why? Because pessimistic people normally latch on to the negative alternative, even if percentage-wise, negative alternative is less. Right? So changing our way of thinking, arguing with ourselves, means let's see what are the alternatives. What are the alternatives in terms of what that person might have meant? Okay, so the fact is, the evidence is right. The person actually cut me off. That's true. But what's the alternatives? Maybe the alternatives is happened for a different reason. Now, I want to just bring in something very, very quickly here, briefly, that again, these concepts, and that's why I'm marrying the two things together, these concepts are so amazing when we add the Torah perspective, the Jewish perspective to this. Let's take something that happens to us. We've talked about this many times, but let's take the case where the car intercepted us or cut us off. The truth is that when someone cuts us off and takes our parking spot, it's actually not relevant whether they saw me or not. It's actually from a Jewish perspective. In other words, if I challenge my thinking, I have to go through a whole thing. Maybe he didn't mean it, maybe he did mean it. The truth is it's not even relevant. Why is it not relevant? Because if we explore real, true, fundamental Jewish belief, then the belief is if someone cut me off, it was meant to happen. And if it was meant to happen, there's a purpose, because nothing happens to me without a purpose. And it can be something as trivial as something as someone cutting me off. It means it's my test to control myself. It means it's my opportunity to become a stronger and a better person by not swearing, by not responding. And it doesn't even matter to me what the person had in mind. It makes no difference. Because obviously I try to act responsibly, but if something, because fundamental to the way we think is, Jewishly, is that everything is bashkacha pratit. Again, we have no control over the things that happen to us outside, including, and this is a very deep philosophical idea which I don't have time to go into in great detail, including if what the person did to me was morally wrong and they had a choice. And this is something we've talked about before. When something happens to me that wasn't my choice, I have to believe it was meant to happen. Even though they might have had a choice, and that's their calculation between them and God. If someone insults me, it's an opportunity for me to work through it. Now, it might mean talking to them respectfully, it might mean resolving it, it might even mean terminating a friendship if I can't get on with the person, whatever the case. But it doesn't mean getting into a spiral of negativity and getting into a spiral of screaming or anger, because those things are all negative, right? But it becomes so much easier, not easier, because these things are never easy, but it becomes more understandable, or at least a little bit easier, when we keep on reflecting on the Jewish principles that go with this concept of challenging our belief system and challenging our messages in our brain, that we reframe things and we completely understand them differently. If it happened to me, it was meant to happen, and it's an opportunity for me to be stronger. Then he talks about implication. And this is a really, really important thing. Sometimes things happen which are clearly wrong. And then we need to decide, okay, so I'm negative about it, and I just can't see any, there's no positive evidence, there's no way it couldn't have happened, it was just completely wrong, or it was a real mistake, or whatever the case is. So now I have a choice. I can still be pessimistic and I can still be negative about it because I'm really now being what I call a realist, right? Or I cannot. I need to decide what's the implications of me being negative. What's the implications in me sustaining my negative beliefs? Will I be more successful? Will it be better tomorrow? No. So in other words, the more I sustain negative beliefs, the harder it's going to become to bounce back, the harder it's going to become to be successful, the harder it's going to be happy, the harder it's going to be to grow. Because growth never comes from negativity. So sometimes when we have beliefs which are hard to challenge, we have to challenge it at least on the basis of implication. What am I choosing? You've heard me say this before. Sometimes, you know, we've had a dispute with someone and we are absolutely right. And let's say we are right. And we take a very negative way of dealing with it and we become very unhappy and angry. And we're absolutely right. I am right. So I often say about children, you've heard me say this before, that children choose between being right or being happy. So it's your choice. You can be right. I know people who are right all their lives and very miserable people. And they're tucker right because they stand for justice. They stand for justice. They stand for being right. Extremely negative individuals because they always are being right. And they are right. They're very honest. They check the evidence. Believe me. They check the evidence to make sure it's correct. And it is correct. But they just choose to be right. Okay? So we need to know what the implications of being negative are. And similarly, the usefulness. What's the usefulness of being negative? What am I going to accomplish by being negative? And so on and so forth. So these are some of the things which we use to dispute the way we believe. So again, briefly, the formula is A, B, C, D, E. We have to understand what the adversity is, and we have them every single day. We have to recognize. This is the hard part. Because it happens so quickly, we need to know why it's happening, right? The hard part is to actually understand what is the belief system that follows the adversity. What is the consequence of that belief system? If your belief system is positive already and the consequence is positive, then you can stop there and you're doing well. But very often it's not that way. We respond negatively. The consequence is a negative response because our belief system was negative. We have to go then and dispute. We have to learn to dispute our messages in our brain and to replay them and to replace them with positive messages, with positive belief systems. And it's a very hard thing to do, but we actually have to try. We have to he recommends we have to actually document these things. We have to take every day and a couple of things that happen, break it down. What is the action? What is the belief? What was the consequence? How can I dispute the belief? And then disputing the belief will lead to re-energization. So yes, I wasn't that bad. Breaking the diet last night wasn't so terrible. The fact that someone didn't call me isn't so. I'm back. I'm bouncing back. The consequence is different. I'm now re-energized and I'm ready to go. Now, all of this is great formula, but how does it all work? In other words, what energizes us to do this? So one thing I want to revisit, and this is more from Dr. Pelkowitz's book, is revisiting the concept of gratitude. What is the definition of gratitude? And just, this is not a series on gratitude, and we've done this before, I just want to go into it a bit more. When I talk about gratitude, I'm not talking about saying thank you as a response to something that someone did really, really well. Someone gave you a gift, so you say thank you. That's part of gratitude. I'm talking about gratitude as a mindset, as a whole way of thinking. And gratitude as a mindset means building and training ourselves to notice the good when it's not obvious. Okay? And this is critical. When we train ourselves to notice the good when it's not obvious, because there's always some good, then we're training our minds to think positively. When we train our minds to think positively, then when adversity happens and we have the ABC model, it becomes a lot easier to challenge our thinking because we're starting to train ourselves to be positive. So if we want to be able to implement that ABCDE model properly, we need to have a general drive to notice positivity, to notice good. You know what's amazing? Again, from a Jewish perspective, in Hebrew, Jews are called Yehudim, right? Now, actually, the origin of this is one of the tribes was called Yehuda. But actually, we're coming up in a few weeks to the festival of Purim, and that's where we have the source that all Jews are called Yehudim, because in the Megillah, the hero of the story of Purim was Mordechai. Mordechai did not come from Yehuda, he came from Binyamin, he was actually Ish Yemini, he was called. But nevertheless, when the Megillah introduces Mordechai, it says Ish Yehudi, and throughout the Megillah story, it refers to the Jews as Yehudim. You know what the word Yehudi means? It has a few translations. The origin of Yehudi is when one of the tribes, Yehuda, was born, and his mother, Leah, was not expecting. She expected only to have three children because of a whole story that the matriarchs were prophetesses and they realized that Jacob would have 12 sons and they thought each one would have three. And then she gave birth to this fourth child, which was an amazing gift, an unexpected gift. She called him Yehuda from the expression of Hoda'ah, to thank, Toda. Right? The essence of Jewishness is the concept of gratitude. The essence of Jewishness is understanding the gifts that comes to us from God, understanding the gift of life, understanding that everything we have is from God, and being thankful and acknowledging. Hoda'ah also means to acknowledge that we have it and where it comes from. So much so that the Talmud has a very, very fascinating sentence which needs to be explored a bit more in detail, but very briefly. There's a prayer which we say every day, and the prayer is called Mizmor LeTodah. It's a thanksgiving prayer. And in times of temples, there was a sacrifice that someone would bring if they wanted to say thank you to God for something amazing. And the Talmud says that in times to come, in future messianic times, there will be a period where other prayers will not be said anymore. And other sacrifices like sin offerings and other things won't be brought anymore, with the exception of two things. The prayer of thanksgiving will always be said. The sacrifice of thanksgiving will always be offered. That's how important hoda'ah, that's how important the concept of gratitude is. Now, gratitude is not always an easy thing. I saw a little, in his book, a little cute story. He says he heard once from a person the following story. This person's father was a very well-known, generous person, and he would always go out of his way to do favors for people and help people out. And one day in shul, there was a guy called Reb Yankel who was very angry with him. So he said to him, "Reb Yankel, why are you angry with me? I haven't even done you a favor yet." In other words, there's a little bit of research that says that sometimes people actually don't want to feel indebted to other people. It's part of self-centeredness. That's why gratitude is sometimes hard. We actually don't want to feel indebted to someone else. I don't want to owe anyone favors. I don't want, you know, that kind of thing. But that's a silly thing, because we are dependent on other people. Of course, independence is a very, very positive thing. But we're here as a unit. We are here to help each other. We are here to reach out to others when we need help, and we are there to help others when they need help. And gratitude fosters that. So we need to understand that gratitude can sometimes subconsciously or psychologically be a difficult thing, but yet it's an important concept. How do we develop gratitude? So the number one impediment to having a life of gratitude is what he calls habituation. Habit. Taking things, the good things of life, for granted. He said he was once giving a speech, a lecture at a beautiful, beautiful resort. There was a hotel. The beauty, the view was just absolutely picturesque. It was amazing. And he engaged one of the hotel staff in conversation, and he said to him, "Is it possible ever to get used to working here? Like you know, it's like, it's amazing. I mean, you must come. It's must be the most beautiful thing. You come every day. You look out the window, the grass, the view, the greenery. It's just amazing." And the guy said, "To me, this is just a job. I don't notice the beauty anymore. I drag my feet coming to work every Monday morning, just like everyone else." Right? And that's the story of life. It's so sad. Every person, even when we have challenges, especially if they're just small challenges. They might be challenges. Sometimes they're significant challenges. For every one of us wakes up in the morning and there's a lot of beautiful things that have happened. And building a life of gratitude means to learn not to take things for granted. To learn to notice those things. To learn to appreciate the things that happen every single day, but they're no less beautiful. I think Nachmanides once said, the difference between nature and a miracle is just how often it happens. Right? The truth is, when the sun rises every single morning, it is no less spectacular than the sea splitting when the Jews left Egypt. What's the difference? If we believe it all comes from God, sun rising in the morning is an amazing thing. Trees growing is an amazing concept. Breathing is an amazing concept. The human body is so unbelievably complex. Just to exist is miraculous. But because it happens every day, we stop taking it for granted. We only notice the things that are out of the ordinary. So sometimes we'll appreciate an amazing, spectacular event, or we'll notice the things that go wrong, not according to plan, when things didn't quite work the way they're supposed to work every single day. And that's why, to develop a mindset of gratitude and develop that whole positive thing of noticing good, it actually means developing the skill of paying attention. That's what it is. It's developing the skill of paying attention. It's very linked to what we spoke about when we did mindfulness. Right? It's about paying attention to the mundane, paying attention to the small things, the beauty of every single day life experience. You know, in a developing a habit of attention is a hard thing to do. One of the tools that Judaism gives us, which doesn't necessarily automatically work unless we use it properly, because that can also become habit, is parts of our prayers. Now, I've said this before, there's an amazing set of prayers or blessings that we make every single morning when we wake up. First of all, we say the Modeh Ani. Modeh Ani is about waking up in the morning and just thanking God for being alive and for breathing. You heard me say this by the mindfulness course, that when we, the fact that we have the breathing, the word for breathing in Hebrew is nishima, to breathe. The word for soul is nishama, the soul. Right? The fact that we wake up, we're able to breathe in rhythm, and our soul's expressed itself through the breathing, That in itself deserves us to just be unbelievably happy. The simcha, the joy of waking up in the morning and be able to have another day of opportunity and to be able to breathe is an amazing thing. Modeani, that's why the first thing we say in the day is Modeani. But then there are morning blessings. In the Siddur, if you have a look, there's something called the morning blessings. And the morning blessings is thanking God for the things that we would never even think about. That's what the problem is, we don't pay attention. We thank God for opening up our eyes in the morning. We thank God for putting on clothes. We expect to wake up in the morning and to get dressed, right? But the fact that we have clothes to put on is an amazing thing. Lots of people don't. Right? To be able to walk straight, to be able to talk, to anything. These are a whole string of morning blessings. It's a training. If we say them slowly, we say that we should be, because the problem is sometimes we say the prayers like we don't notice anything else, because everything becomes habit, so that's a problem. But if we pay attention to these prayers and to these words, it becomes amazing. It's the idea of, I'm thanking God for what? For walking, just be able to see in the morning. Or the blessings that we have on food. We take an apple and it's just a normal thing. You want to grab an apple and we eat it. Just hold on a second. It's a gift. The apple is a gift. It's all along this process of seeing the good. And we have challenges and things do go difficult, but the things that are challenging don't take away the things that are working. The gifts of life. The gifts of life are still there. It's a matter of being able to notice them, notwithstanding that the guy cut me off or the day didn't go as planned or someone insulted me or just the regular things that go wrong sort of every single day. So if we're talking about developing a mindset of gratitude, here's some of the strategies. Right? Number one is to notice the blessings. The other thing, and this is very, very psychologically in the literature, it's been now documented that gratitude is often developed when we express gratitude. Right? We have to actually not just notice it. Paying attention is one thing, but then expressing it. Whether it's expressing it to God or expressing it to other people. It tells a beautiful story of a teacher that was talking to an 11th grade student. And the 11th grade student said, you know, that my success in my school life at the moment is all because of a third grade teacher that was so good and inspired me, and I still remember that third grade teacher. So the 11th grade teacher said to the 11th grade students, tell me, you know, the teacher still teaches in the school. Have you ever said thank you? So no, I didn't think of that. So why don't you go now and ask that teacher, you want to speak to them for a few minutes, and tell them what they've done. Now, first of all, that's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful gift. It's a beautiful gift to get feedback and for people to know they've made an impact on other people's lives. But as I've always said, gratitude is not only for the people that we're showing gratitude for. Gratitude is for us. When we express it specifically, speech enhances it. Speech builds it and makes it more concrete. To be able to express directly and say thank you to the people who made a difference in our life is an amazing thing. There's so many people that do good things to us. So many people that sometimes just small gestures. We just need to get used to bringing it out, used to expressing it. I just had a cute little experience yesterday. I was reading this, and it's Dr. Pelkovitz's book, and it was helpful for today's lesson. And I happened to have his email. I thought to myself, hold on a second, I got to practice what I preach. So I stopped in the middle, and I found his email, because I've been in contact with him before. And I said, I just want you to know I've been reading your book, and it's really helpful. Thank you very much. And it's interesting, he's a very, very busy guy. Within 10 minutes, I got a reply back. He said, really, thank you very much. It's nice to hear that, right? So that's the concept. The other idea is that gratitude is only really enhanced when we deal with our ego a little bit. And this is a very, very important part, and just very, very briefly. Gratitude is about not being, you see, when we're self-absorbed, then it's like the woman who said, my kid had a hat on. In other words, when we're self-absorbed, it's hard to notice the good things because there's never enough. So part of developing gratitude is to focus on others, not to be so self-absorbed, to understand, to lower our expectations, to make sure that we don't have the sense of entitlement, right? Because when we focus less on ourselves, we're able to appreciate the things that we do have in a much, much stronger way. And that's such an important thing to developing gratitude. So let's just put this all together. We all have little things that go wrong every day, the adversity. We have belief systems that respond to that adversity, and those belief systems bring consequences. Our challenge is to build a mindset of positivity, which is to, when we have adversity, we have little challenges, to challenge our belief. Disputation, to dispute, to argue with our own belief system and to replace them with much more positive messages. which will then be re-energize ourselves. How we do that is generally learning to become a grateful person. Grateful person means generally learning to notice the good that's not obvious. We notice the good that's not obvious by realizing, by paying attention, by not taking things for granted, by getting up every morning and trying to focus, every day maybe, at the end of the day, to make a list of 5 good things that happened that day, 5 gifts that we have that day, whatever the case is. It doesn't take away from dealing with things that we need to deal with, but at least it makes our whole mindset a much stronger and a much more positive one. And if we do all of that, it makes it a lot easier then when we have a real challenge to actually go through the journey of resilience with its setbacks and all its failures, but nevertheless it makes it much more, much, much stronger. And I want to just end off with a beautiful, beautiful story, which I know I've told you months before, and for those who were here Monday night by the gratitude, it's one of my favorite stories, so I'm going to tell it again. It's a story that took place in 1995 with Yitzchak Perlman, the violinist. And he was having a concert at the Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center, New York City. Now, those of you know, Yitzchak Perlman, of course, has a disability. He had polio as a child. So for him to walk on the stage is a challenge in its own right. He is on crutches, he has braces on his feet, and he wobbles onto the stage very slowly, undoes his braces, and then takes the violin, and he's transported to a different world. If you've watched the video, you've been in one of his concerts. So this particular concert, the normal routine takes its place. He walks onto the stage, it takes a long time, he undoes his braces, takes his violin, is about to start playing, and he starts to play, and then something terrible happens. After a few bars, there's a loud snap. One of the strings of his violin snapped. And you could hear that snap in the whole concert hall, and everyone went dead quiet. So what everyone expected him to do was to stop, put upon his braces, back his crutches, wobble down, get another violin or another string, whatever the case is. But he didn't do that. He stopped for a few moments, he turned to the conductor and motioned to the conductor to continue. And I'm going to read it to you because the article is written so beautifully. He said he waited a moment, closed his eyes, and then signaled to the conductor to begin again. The orchestra began and he played from where he had left off, and he played with such passion and such power and such purity that they'd never heard before. Of course, anyone knows that it's impossible to play a symphonic work with just 3 strings. I know that, you know that. But that night, Yitzchak Perlman refused to know that. You could see him modulating, changing, recomposing the piece in his head. At one point, it sounded like he was detuning the strings to get new sounds from them that they'd never made before. When he finished, there was an awesome silence in the room. And then people rose and cheered. There was an extraordinary outburst of applause from every corner of the auditorium. We were all on our feet, screaming and cheering, doing everything we could to show how much we appreciated what he had just done. He smiled, wiped the sweat from his brow, raised his bow to quiet us, and then he said, not boastfully, but in a quiet, pensive, reverent tone, he said, "You know, sometimes it's the artist's task to find out how much music you can still make with what you have left." And the article goes on to say that's the story of life. We all have a violin, and sometimes some of our strings snap. The task of an artist is to see the challenge that we have challenged ourselves, is to see how much beautiful music we can still produce from the 3 strings we have left. That's what resilience is all about, and that's what positivity is all about. When we develop a positive mindset, when we challenge our beliefs, when we learn to be thankful and notice the good, producing the music from the 3 remaining strings becomes a lot easier. In the next coming weeks, we're going to also focus on various strategies, again, back to resilience, of how this whole process works. Have a great week.